Dr. Bill Newsom is an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a professor of neurobiology at Stanford University. He's a leading investigator in the fields of visual and cognitive neuroscience. More specifically, he's made some fundamental contributions to our understanding of the neural mechanisms underlying visual perception and simple forms of decision-making. If you check him out on his website, you'll find that he has many, many different prizes, so many that I won't even take time even mentioning some of them, so I'd refer you there to see what a decorated career he's had to this point. But maybe just point out that he was inducted into the National Academy of Sciences in 2000, and then into the American Philosophical Society in 2011. He's published over 100 different journal articles, and I'm really excited to hear what he has to say for us tonight. So would you please help me in welcoming him for his talk tonight of Two Minds, A Neuroscientist Bounces Science and Faith.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I was told that for the video purposes, I need to put this thing on. My mother always told me to get dressed before I gave talks. There we go. I was reminded when M&M's got handed out there that I'm 64 years old and I've been eating M&M's all my life and I have no idea what M&M stands for. Absolutely not. Mars is one of them, I gather. I also found out I got one of the yellow packages and on the back it says partially made with genetic engineering. So if you have any religious or ethical objections to GMOs, you better trade colors right now. I also saw that it's 250 calories, so even if you don't have that. So I'm pleased to talk with you tonight about this topic of two minds and neuroscience balances science and faith. Since I have two minds, I'm going to try to do two topics, okay? There are two goals to this talk. One is to take you to what I consider the sort of a quick cook's tour of the cutting edge of neuroscience, where the real, you know, vigorous, I'm almost say revolutionary stuff is going on right now. And then I'm going to spend the second part of the talk reflecting about what progress in neuroscience is and neuroscientific understanding of mind and behavior, how that interacts with my religious faith. And, Rodin's thinker seemed appropriate for someone with two minds and constantly trying to balance these interests. So he's kind of a theme here tonight. Now, my students always tell me before giving any talk that I should always provide the big picture first. So the big picture is this. You're here. As far as we know, this lonely galaxy. But the amazing thing to those of us who study neuroscience is that everything you know about that world and that galaxy and the planet we live on and everything you do to act on your world is mediated through these 3 pounds of flesh sitting between your ears that we call the brain. And that is the sort of the consuming passion of my professional life has been to start making some small contributions to understanding how that works. Many of us neuroscientists were really startled in January of 2013 when President Obama mentioned in his State of the Union address, actually, that he mentioned some brain initiative that none of us had ever heard of. And it turned out that this was quite serious, that the White House had decided to start a major U.S. national initiative in brain science. And the NIH, Francis Collins, who's well known to many of you, decided to get out in front of this and get some organization and planning. And some of you know that I co-chaired that planning committee for the U.S. Brain Initiative with Corey Bargman from Rockefeller University. And together, we and 15 others on our really excellent committee produced this sort of this report here, trying to anticipate the next 10 to 12 years of brain research in the United States and where the real opportunities were, where a very focused initiative could make a difference. You can download this report if you have trouble sleeping at night. It's actually quite good. It was a privilege to step out of the lab and actually do something like this. The focus of the report is on circuits and networks because that's where we feel like the real cutting edge is. And we took it as our purpose to map the circuits of the brain, measure the fluctuating patterns of electrical and chemical activity flowing within those circuits, and then understand how their interplay creates our unique cognitive and behavioral capabilities. And you might ask, there's all those interesting molecules out there, there's all those interesting human brain imaging data, why did you choose to focus on this little circuits and networks piece? And the reason is that we've had 60 years now of single unit recording, measuring neurons one at a time with electrodes to the brain. We've had, you know, depending on where you count birth and molecular biology happening, we've had at least 40 years of, you know, genetic engineering style molecular biology. And we've had 20, 25 years of human brain imaging. But what's missing is that cognition and emotion, memory, action are generated by circuits and networks of thousands to millions of interconnected neurons. And that's kind of the central black hole between molecules and signal neurons on the one hand and whole brain images on the other. There's this vast lacuna of knowledge we have about circuits and networks. And so that's what we sort of outlined as the focus of this 10-year brain initiative. And it's really a project in reverse engineering. Okay, which should warm many of your hearts as you come from engineering backgrounds. It's an enormously complicated system, of course, to reverse engineer. Each of us have 100 billion neurons, give or take a few billion, in our heads. Each neuron makes about 1,000 synapses, so you've got 100 trillion synapses in your brain. So it's enormously complicated, and this is what it looks like if you actually pop the hood, right? You take off the flat skull, you cut the dura, and you look down at this thing, you know, and you know, then you say, our job is to reverse engineer this thing. And the first question that typically comes to my mind is, where are the knobs on this thing? Now, if someone asked you to reverse engineer something like this, you would start by looking at its behavior. You'd start, you know, there's some knobs up here to turn, some buttons to push, and we could start making some inferences. Then we pop the lid on it and we see something like this. We see circuits. That's what's on the inside of one of those things. And, you know, engineers, especially defense-related engineers, are sometimes asked to reverse engineer circuits like this. Our tools have been really limited in brain science. And over the course of my career, you know, which spans about 40 years in this business now, I would say that there have been four critical challenges that we've made, you know, small amounts of headway on, but now over the next 10 years, we're going to make substantial new headway because of new techniques that have just been invented, new technologies that have been given to us in the last several years. And the first one is just to get a static map of the circuit diagram, right? That's not so ambitious to want. I mean, if you want to reverse engineer something, you need a circuit diagram. But secondly, it's not just enough to have a static circuit diagram, right? You want to measure the signal dynamics. You actually want to know what signals are flowing in various parts of the circuit. And then you want to be able to manipulate those signals and test the effects on behavior. So if you actually think you know something about signal dynamics and what they mean, you'd like to do controlled manipulations and see if you can actually predict the outcome of them. And then finally, we need theory. Theory at all levels, from networks, data analytics, computer simulations, handling the large data sets that are coming in now that I'll tell you about in just a moment. And the good news is I think that the barriers are falling on all four of these fronts. And I just want to take you on this quick cook's tour just to give you some examples of what I'm talking about before we turn to the more philosophical and religiously oriented topics. So the first thing is that we have these new techniques, brand new techniques in neuroanatomy, such as the Clarity technique published by the Dysorov lab at Stanford about 3 years ago now. In the old days, the way we would try to decipher the circuitry of a mouse brain, which you see up here over a patch of text, is slice it with a device called a microtome into very thin sections, like a loaf of bread, mount each section laboriously onto a slide, examine them under a microscope, maybe do some tracing, enter those data into the computer, and try to make a 3D reconstruction. Now, there's a revolution here that speeded up this process and made it more flexible and efficient by at least an order of magnitude with a lot of headroom still to go. And Clarity comes from an electrochemical process whereby lipids are extracted out of that whole mouse brain. And that same mouse brain is actually sitting on the same text in the right-hand image. And you can vaguely see it there over the EXPL and Explore. But fundamentally, lipids are what make the mouse brain and any brain opaque. And once they're extracted, you can actually see through it. It becomes transparent. Before lipid extraction, there's a gel kind of chemical manipulation that locks the proteins, nucleic acids, and other molecules together so the cell structure remains. And once you get this clarified brain like this, you can actually do histological staining of neurons that use different transmitters. And then you can essentially take your slices and trace these neurons and their axons and see what kinds of connections they're making just by focusing a microscope up and down through the clarified brain, right? No more slicing It's really a remarkable thing. This was published in Nature. I want to show you 2 minutes of a video clip from Nature that accompanied the publication, just so you get an idea what this power can do. And I emphasize, this is not a reconstruction. These are actual video clips going through the brain.
We're heading into the center of a mouse's brain, into the hippocampus, where memory is formed. Looking up, you can see neurons projecting to the surface of the brain. This is the work of Carl Dysrop and his team at Stanford University. By making the entire brain transparent, they were able to image it using a light microscope. They called the new technique clarity. Existing techniques for studying the brain's wiring are often limited to looking at very small volumes of the brain, or they don't allow you to label genes or chemicals of interest. The advantage of clarity is that you can label lots of molecules in whole brains.
So that gives you a feel for what we're talking about here, and it's remarkable because you can wash out that stain, you can then put in another stain, you can track the pathways labeled by other neurotransmitter systems, and this is yielding now static maps of connectivity within the whole brain that are remarkable in nature. And that first publication actually showed that it seems to work on human postmortem material as well, which means that the human brain is within reach neuroanatomically, which has never been the case before. So that's kind of, you know, a revolutionary advance on the circuits front. Now, in terms of signal dynamics, this is another really amazing thing. This is from a paper that was published the same year, 2013. It came out of HHMI, Geomelia Farr, Misha Ahrens, Phil Keller, and their colleagues. This is what you're doing here is looking down on the top of the zebrafish brain. That blue outline you see is the outline of the zebrafish's head. The zebrafish is fully awake, it's not anesthetized, but it's immobilized and agar. So it's sitting there very still so that you can image the brain with a microscope. Zebrafish has been genetically manipulated so that every cell in the brain actually has a calcium indicator in it, which fluoresces bright orange or yellow when calcium flows into the cell. Calcium flows in when the cell is electrically active, so when you see this fluorescence coming and going, it's because the cells are actually active. And they can image up and down through this brain and actually record about 80% of the 100,000 neurons that are present in this brain. And I'll just show you this. This is, you know, for someone who spent most of his career recording from neurons one at a time, this is completely mesmerizing. And, you know, I have odd tastes, I admit. But you can see little groups of neurons that are actually coming off on and off in antiphase with each other. You can see some that are correlated, some that are completely uncorrelated. You can start making inferences about connections. You can see stuff going down to the spinal cord to your right and along here in just a few seconds. It's a big flash. Well, what was that? Was that a zebrafish thought? Was it epileptic convulsion? I'll just let you look at this again because I find it's in this book. I mean, this is the stuff of neuroscience fantasy for people like me of my generation. To be able to get rich data sets like this are just astounding. Maybe somebody just slams the door in the lab here when this flash comes on. I mean, I don't know, honestly. And of course, then you can see one of the limitations of this kind of prep, right? What you really want as a neuroscientist is not only have activity with this kind of detail, you want behavior. And you want to see how the activity is related to behavior, but you're not going to get much behavior out of an animal that's immobilized like this. So this is one of the tricks that people are working on right now, how to get these rich, enormous data sets and getting behavior at the same time. So dynamics is coming. Now the third thing tool that we really want to reverse engineer is manipulation. If the ability to go in, if you really look at the dynamics, you look at the relationship to behavior, you think of a hypothesis about what this circuit, its activity is doing, you'd really like to manipulate that activity, either ramp it up and see if it has a predictive effect on behavior or silence a particular group of neurons. And this technique called optogenetics was invented again in the Dysrop lab at Stanford about 10 years ago. It's taken the world of neuroscience by storm. Basically, it's genetic engineering tricks that you can play that get these molecules that are light sensitive, and they're also ion channels, into the membranes of any population of cells over which you have control, genetic access, genetic control. And so you can take, for example, all the layer 5 cortical cells from the primary visual cortex and turn them on and off during ongoing behavior. And what you have to do is arrange to get light into the brain, which is this little fiber optic you can see going into the mouse's brain right here. And that fiber stops on top of a particular group of targeted cells. And I'm going to show you a video clip here of optogenetics in action. This is from David Anderson's lab at Caltech, just published last year. And here they're targeting, using optogenetic technology, a particular class of cells in the medial amygdala, I believe. And they're going to turn on these cells. Now, you're going to see a mouse in this video, and the mouse has a little fiber coming into his head through a skull-mounted attachment. And this is called the female intruder paradigm. So there's a mouse in its home cage, and a female that the male does not know is dropped in. And most mice, myo mice, it turns out, are very, very interested in female intruders. And it's not a deep surprise, right? For those of us who read the Bible, it's not a deep surprise. Here's what happens. And you're going to see words come on, say laser on. So you'll see the mouse is very interested in the novel female. And then this laser comes on with these cells that have been hypothesized to be involved in aggressive behavior. And you'll see actually what happens when the laser comes on. So this is stimulation, you got media, amygdala, particular subdivision. There's a male mouse. He's really inspecting this female. The laser gets turned on right now, and with a short latency, you can see this male goes into hyper-aggression mode, right? And just attacks this poor girl who has no idea why she's being treated this way. And when the laser goes off, right now, he just goes back to being a normal male mouse, acting friendly and all. And I showed this to a group of kind of educated lay people at Stanford taking a course on science of decision making. And one of them said afterwards, that was the most disturbing thing I've ever seen in my life. And you know, I said, you know, it's neuroscience, that's one of the most interesting things I've ever seen. Really need to dissect circuits like this. I mean, one of the reasons this is interesting, right, is because it implies that certain emotional circuits that govern emotional tone can actually be accessed and modulated in a very selective fashion, which is, of course, exactly the kind of tool we'd like to treat depression effectively or any of a number of other psychiatric diseases. So there's potential applications for this. So this is your quick cook's tour. There is remarkable advances on being able to map the circuits. There are remarkable advances on being able to measure the signal dynamics from tens of thousands of neurons simultaneously, which we've never been able to do before in the history of neuroscience. There are remarkable advances in being able to manipulate the signals flowing in specific circuits and test hypotheses. The one where we're lagging a bit is computation in theory. I was warned by a theoretical physicist at Stanford, who some of you may know, Bob Laughlin, who shared the Nobel Prize for theory in superconductivity. He said, you know, when we were talking, waxing enthusiastic about all this data, these beautiful, large new data sets we're getting, he said, be careful what you wish for. You might wind up at the end of 10 years with lots and lots of data and simply be 10 years older. Right? But that's the nightmare outcome, that we have data, but we don't understand what the data mean. Right, and to make progress there, we need fundamental advances in theory, and I think that dynamic systems theory has got to be applied to the brain in a big way. Understanding recurrent neural networks and principles that underlie them, Bayesian approaches to understanding sensory and motor systems, machine learning, all of this is going to be playing a big role in neuroscience over the coming years. So the promise of understanding circuits at this level are circuit-based interventions, really. I mean, you know, for me, I'm driven by curiosity, but deep brain stimulation, which many of you have heard of, actually arose out of painstaking work across 2 decades understanding the circuitry of the basal ganglia, which are summarized in that little circuit diagram you see. But now, Parkinson's patients who are resistant, who have grown resistant to the standard drug therapy, L-DOPA, over 100,000 in the world now have had electrodes implanted in deep in the brain in a pair of nuclei called the subthalamic nuclei, and they're stimulated about 100 hertz 24/7, and this can give people 2 to 3 years of their lives back, get people up out of wheelchairs and have them running across their backyards again. It's not uniformly effective, but it's effective in a substantial number of the patients. It's not a cure for the disease. It's a neurodegenerative disease. The degeneration continues happening, but it can give people years of their lives back. I actually have some video clips that I show in other talks. I'd be happy to show any of you who want to see it afterwards, or you can look it up yourself on YouTube. Just YouTube, just search on Parkinson's deep brain stimulation. I was describing that, and I really hadn't shown it to you. Okay, here we go. So I'll just say one thing, that even the issues of volition and consciousness are, I think, can come under inspection in neuroscience in the future. This is a paper that was published in Science in 2009. This is a group of neurosurgeons who were doing neurosurgery and brain stimulation on awake, alert human patients who they could converse with. Neurosurgeons do this in order to when they're considering severe treatment for severe epilepsy that involves removal of certain pieces of the cortex. They want to get in and stimulate and identify the language areas, identify the primary motor areas before they start removing brain tissue, right? But while they're in there, they stimulate and accrue scientific data while they're at it. Now, I can summarize the story for you here. Those colored areas you see, there's one toward the front of the brain, the purple one. This is the premotor cortex. And then there's parietal motor regions in orange and yellow toward the back. And these guys made a pretty startling discovery. And they found that when they electrically stimulated that purple zone up there in premotor cortex, they could actually get twitches of muscle in the periphery, or occasionally even the entire limb to move. But the patient would deny having moved their limb. And they actually verified this through EMG recordings and such. The patient would deny. If they actually made the patient look at their arm and they stimulated the premotor cortex and the patient saw the arm move, they'd say, yes, it moved, but I didn't do that. You guys must have done it. Okay? But if they put electrodes back there in the yellow and orange, the parietal region, they could stimulate the parietal region, and the patient would report, I feel the urge to move my hand, or I did move my hand, even when they could demonstrate with EMG recordings from the muscle that the hand didn't move at all. So somewhere between that yellow and orange blob and that purple blob lies this sense of will or volition to execute voluntary movements. And I don't know about you, but I want to know everything there is to know about this, right? This is one of the deepest secrets, most interesting secrets about the brain. And I think, you know, we can get to these things in the future. So this kind of leads to what I call the central dogma of neuroscience. Some of you may remember Francis Crick talking about the central dogma of molecular biology, you know, genes lead to RNA, lead to proteins. And the central dogma of neuroscience, I would phrase it this way, that all of our behavior and all of our mental life, including our sense of a conscious continuing self, is inextricably linked to the biology of the brain. Now, I chose my language there very carefully. I didn't say cause, determinant. I said it's inextricably linked to the biology of the brain. And I would interpret that to kind of be a central dogma that all of us working neuroscientists carry with us when we go into the lab to work every day. Now, when I talk about it to this kind of stuff to Stanford undergraduates, inevitably somebody says, what about free will? Okay, if our decision-making and our will is governed by these neural mechanisms, then are we free to do anything? And I kind of like this answer, and I don't know who said this. It sounds like something Woody Allen would say, but I don't think it was him. He said, I'm not a fatalist, but even if I were, what can I do about it? Clever dodge, right? So I tell students that, you know, there's several approaches to thinking about freedom in the brain, or if you're religiously oriented, thinking about the soul, you know, this high-level entity that we call the soul. And I say that, you know, some people, a lot of neuroscientists, my neuroscience colleagues in general, probably their default assumption is that, you know, bottom-up determinism is at work here, that behavior really is governed by the grinding of neural gears deep in the brain and sort of our conscious explanations of our behavior are kind of rationalizations laid down on top of the deep gears. But I don't like that one very much, and I tell them why I don't like it very much. Some people say that quantum mechanics, John Polkinghorne, believes that quantum mechanics creates degrees of freedom in the brain to avoid a deterministic outcome. And I'm not really sold on that either. And in a longer version of this talk, I would tell you why. I think that a lot of people, the average person in the street out there, runs around with this kind of definition of freedom. That freedom, free behavior and free choice means uncaused choice. And if there's a cause, if there's a biological cause, then you're not free. And I reject that definition, okay? What I think freedom really is, it's about self-determination, or what I call autonomy. So let's say a little bit more about that. What do I mean by this self-determination? It means, this is elementary, this is my definition, my behavior is caused at least in part, and I'm emphasizing the at least in part, by my values, my beliefs, my memories, my goals, my aspirations. Okay? Now, I'm willing to concede that a great amount of my behavior, probably even a large majority, comes from influences that I'm not even aware of, right? Social psychologists are excellent at showing this, that, you know, we believe we're making a choice for reason X, but they can show that there are all these other reasons that we're not even conscious of that actually contributes to our choices. So we can argue what that percentage is. You know, what percentage are we actually consciously in control of, and what percentage are we not even conscious of? And, you know, I might give you, 85% of my behavior is driven by stuff that I'm not even aware of. But, you know, at least in part, that 15% is really critical. And self-determination means that at least some part of it is caused by beliefs, values, memories, goals, aspirations, these high-level concepts that I consider to be high-level states of organization of the nervous system. And so the second thing here that I'm saying is that conscious, rational thought plays a causal role in my behavior. It's not an epiphenomena floating along on top. It actually plays a causal role in my behavior. One of the stories that I tell about this is I'm a Southerner. Some of you can probably hear from my accent. I grew up in the South during the Jim Crow era in the 50s and 60s. And I carried along lots of cultural assumptions about race and all that just was like eating and breathing to me. And it wasn't until, the real civil rights action in the 60s in my country that I became aware that there was a very different way to relate to these issues and think about these issues and feel about these issues. And in part, in becoming conscious of that, and then in part being informed by my religious belief, I decided I really need to change. You know, this culture I was growing up was really on the wrong track here. But you cannot correct a prejudice until you become conscious of that prejudice to begin with. Whether it's grading papers, like most of you do, and favoring one group over another group, whether it's hiring faculty, like many of you do on search committees, no matter what it is, you can't correct a prejudice until you become conscious that you are prejudiced. So that's just one example where I would say conscious rational thought plays a causal role in behavior. So I don't buy the whole epiphenomenal thing. And to me, the key issue here is what is it that counts as a cause? Now, if we start playing, and the key point of conflict, I think, in understanding freedom is to think about what really are your causes in the end. I was a physics undergraduate, and I was taught that there were four fundamental forces in nature, right? There's electricity and magnetism, there's gravity, and there's the weak and strong nuclear forces. And forces are what do the work. Work is force times the distance moved, or whatever it was at that time when I was taking physics. And if you're postulating a force that doesn't move stuff, then you're just out in la la land, okay? And so this is sort of the reductionistic urge in science, to take each level and explain it in terms of the lower levels, and believe that once you get to a lower level, you're somehow more fundamental and somehow more close to reality. And this comes from this is kind of laid out this reasoning. Comes from a nice book, I think, by Carl Craver called Explaining the Brain. He's a philosopher of neuroscience. And Craver traces this, this eliminative, what Nancy Murphy down at Florida calls eliminative reductionism, to this classical model of reduction laid out by Ernst Nagel, a prominent philosopher of science back in the late 40s and through the 50s. And according to the classical model of reduction, I'm quoting Craver here, from which most current models descend, reduction, successful reduction, is a species of a covering law explanation. One theory at one level gets reduced to another when it's possible to define all of the theoretical terms of the first with those of the second, and to derive the first theory from the second. Okay, so this is very strong criteria for what reduction is. And if those conditions are met, then it is questionable whether you need that higher level explanation. Now, Craver calls this kind of philosophy metaphysical fundamentalism. And I like this quote in particular. The metaphysical fundamentalist argues that non-fundamental things, that is anything above ultimately those four forces in physics, non-fundamental things have no causal power over and above fundamental things. They believe roughly that everything has a cause at the fundamental level, it's the principle of causal completeness of the physical, and that nothing has more than one complete cause. That's called the principle of non-overdetermination. And if those two things are true, it follows that no non-fundamental things are causes. So it follows then that my notions of self autonomy or self-determination are illusory, right? Because I want to believe that these higher level things like values and beliefs and my own personal history have causal effects. So I have problems, as you might expect, with this metaphysical fundamentalism, as does Craver. My problems are several, and I won't belabor them. I'm just going to say it doesn't work in real life. You know, the most ardent determinists will still get angry when somebody throws a rock through their window. Now, they won't just say that's the laws of physics at work. That's the way it goes. My second problem is that it doesn't describe what neuroscience actually do. And neuroscience, in fact, biology in general, I think, there is no successful example of, you know, that strong covering law notion of successful reduction. And what we do is link levels, which I'll talk about in a minute. A third problem is the regression issue. I mean, when you start regressing down to more and more fundamentals, man, you're gone. Once you make that commitment, you're all the way down to quantum mechanics, right? Which is the most fundamental theory that we have of the universe at this point. You know, writing a wave equation for motions of all the atoms in this room over the next 20 minutes. I mean, that's where we're headed. So the problem is that even my colleagues in neuroscience, who are, I would consider to be genetic fundamentalists, as opposed to the level at which I work, you know, about circuits and things. Maybe you'd call me a circuit fundamentalist, I don't know. But the problem is, people who really work and believe that answers lie at a particular level, they get really antsy and even angry when somebody tries to tell them that their level is the high level, and really the fundamental answers are at a lower level. The geneticist doesn't like to go down below genes very much, you know, maybe a little bit, maybe structure of the molecules that make the enzymatic reactions more rational and understandable. A fourth problem is at the most fundamental level, when you really get down to physics, is arguably acausal. And Bertrand Russell makes this point, a very famous essay on causality. You know, he points out that your fundamental equations in physics, like equals ma, there's no time variable in there. You can rearrange those terms any way you want to, and it's still the same law. And so it's not as though any of those is more fundamental or causes the other. They're just related according to this particular equation. And the only physical law which really has time in it is entropy. It's the dynamics that entropy always increases with time. So it may be an exception, but in most cases, you don't have causality in physics. And Russell says we should just get rid of that idea. And then I think quantum mechanics is kind of impoverished. I mean, if we could write a wave equation to describe all the motion of all the atoms in this room over the next 20 minutes, we'd have a certain kind of truth, right? We'd know the motions of atoms probabilistically, right? And the further we go forward in time, the lower the probability becomes of any particular outcome. But probabilistically, we could write an equation. But if that's the equation, we say, okay, that's fundamental. Let's get rid of all the non-fundamental stuff. Then we know nothing about people. We know nothing about conferences. We know nothing about hunger. We know nothing about M&Ms. That's not a wave equation, right? Nothing about genetic modification of those M&Ms. It's not a wave equation. So I think it's impoverished. I don't think it's wrong. It's just impoverished. That's all. And so, kind of following Craver, I like to look back at what biologists actually do in the lab, what neuroscientists like myself actually do in the lab. And what we actually do in the lab is multi-level mechanistic explanation, okay? So this is what Craver calls the systems tradition, and some of you physicists, solid-state physicists, may well find this very familiar from your own field. The systems tradition construes explanation as a matter of decomposing systems into their parts, and showing how those parts are organized together in such a way as to exhibit the explanation phenomena, the thing you're trying to explain. Systems explanations involve showing how something works rather than showing that its behavior can be derived from more fundamental laws. As a biologist, I say, yeah. You know, we want to know how the thing works. We're after mechanism, right? It's not really about, I don't really want to get into all these derivations and things. I just want to know how the thing works. And then he defines this thing, and you know, causality is a theme lurking behind all of this, right? And he doesn't take on that directly, but he has this concept, which I love, called mutual manipulability. So he's defining a mechanism here, a biological mechanism, and he says a biological part, like a molecule or a cell or a circuit. It's a component in a mechanism. If one can change the behavior of the mechanism as a whole by intervening to change the component, right? That's one direction of manipulability. You change the component and you change the behavior of the whole. And that is important here, one can change the behavior of the component by intervening to change the behavior of the mechanism as a whole. So he's saying this mutual manipulability. Manipulability goes in both directions, from the high to the low and the low to the high. So let's look at an example of what neuroscientists actually have done. This is not one neuroscientist, this is many, many neuroscientists. They want to understand lots of cognitive phenomena, and one of them is long-term spatial memory. So spatial memory is the kind of thing that helps you find your car in a parking lot like this. And mine is really poor, I can tell you. I don't even remember which parking lot I parked the car in, much less where it is. But many people have good long-term spatial memory. Psychologists, biologists want to understand this, right? So the first thing you do, you have to say, okay, how are we going to measure this in the lab? So we typically will set up mice navigating some kind of maze. A water maze is typically used these days, but you know, standard land mazes can be used as well. Now, we can quantify that behavior. How quickly can the mouse solve the maze? We can do it over and over again. We can look at inter-animal variability, so we can really study this behavioral level. We have learned that a structure called the hippocampus actually generates a spatial map inside the mouse's brain, and the hippocampus is actually critical for this behavior. And this mutual manipulability is important here. If you change the maze, you change the map in the hippocampus. So that's the downward thing. But if you go in and manipulate the hippocampus by anesthetizing it, then the mouse loses its way in the maze. So you go back and forth in both directions. And if one of those doesn't work, you're mistaken. I beg your pardon, you don't have your hands on the mechanism. If you can change the behavior and the hippocampus doesn't change, or if you can change the hippocampus and the behavior doesn't change, then you're off on the wrong track. Now, many people say, well, how in the world does the hippocampus set up this map in the first place? And we know a lot about the cellular level, about this long-term potentiation, which is a key model way for synapses to change strength. We know a lot about that, and again, we can change the map in the hippocampus, and we can see LTP acting at the cellular level. We can go in and block some of the molecules that are responsible for LTP, and we can show that the hippocampus does not generate new maps or doesn't generate them as well. So, you know, it's the mutual manipulability. You feel like, yeah, we're on the mechanism here. But people want to know, how does LTP work? I mean, well, that's not magic. There are molecules that do that. And we know a lot about NMDA receptors and the special role they play in synaptic plasticity. But, you know, my genetics friends want to go beyond that. I want to say, well, if a synapse is going to change strength, and that's our central dogma for how long-term memory works, you know, if you remember anything about this talk in the morning, it'll be because we're changing the strengths of synapses in your brain right now. Okay? Physical changes in your brain right now. And genes will reproduce more receptor molecules. So what does this all mean? Okay? What it all means is that this notion of self-determination or autonomy or responsibility, I said the key issue is what counts as a cause. And I think that this notion of mutual manipulability is really critical. If we can find a way to talk meaningfully about non-fundamental causation, and I think we must, then we can take mental causation and personal responsibility for action seriously. So note that I am not saying that bottom-up causes are unimportant, right? I said I might be able to give you 85% of my behaviors, bottom-up causes that I'm barely or not even aware of. I think that explanatory relevance runs both upward and downward in complex systems. So here's a couple of very practical examples. This is a quote from Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene. This is classic Dawkins. He says, genes swarm in huge colonies, safe inside gigantic lumbering robots, that's you and me, by the way, sealed off from the outside world, communicating with it by torturous indirect routes, manipulating it by remote control. They are in you and me. They created us, body and mind, and their preservation is the ultimate rationale for our existence. Now, that's our bottom-up way of looking at genetic influences on behavior, right? Dawkins' colleague, Dennis Nuttall, about 20 years later, wrote this book, The Music of Life, Beyond the Genome, and Nuttall's obviously doing a parody of Dawkins here. He says, genes are trapped in huge colonies, locked inside highly intelligent beings, molded by the outside world, communicating it with it by complex processes through which blindly, as if by magic, function emerges. They are in you and me, and we are the system that allows their code to be read. And their preservation is totally dependent on the joy that we experience in reproducing ourselves. We are the ultimate rationale for their existence. This is a top-down view, right? And I don't want to claim that one of those is true and one of them are false. I think that they're elements of both. This was brought home to me seriously in 2006. This is some of you, most of you maybe know what the Lasker Awards are. It's kind of a biomedical set of awards given by the Lasker Foundation every year. It's kind of a pre-Nobel. Like, I don't know, 20% of Lasker awardees have gone on to win Nobel Prizes, something like that. And this article in the New York Times caught my eye in 2006. A psychiatrist among five chosen for this medical award. This tame-looking gentleman here is Dr. Aaron Beck of the University of Pennsylvania. And the reason he won the Lasker is because he invented cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, those of you who are as old as me, you realize that's a big deal, right? Because psychiatry had such limited tools for so many decades, you know, being from really Freudian analytic talk traditions. And when we started learning about neurotransmitter systems in the brain and started coming out with drugs that could manipulate transmitter systems like serotonin and GABA and stuff, psychiatry just became a prescription writing sort of profession. I had a psychiatry fellow in my lab doing some work, and I said to him, Daniel, what did you learn today in your psychiatry residence? And he said, my new motto is, leave no receptor unoccupied. Okay, now, the reason that Lasker was chosen, that Beck was chosen for this award, is that scientific papers showed, in very nicely controlled studies, multiple studies, take groups of seriously depressed patients, give some the serotonergic reuptake drugs, antidepressants, give some cognitive behavioral therapy, and give another group both. And the answer is very clear that the group that had both treatments did better than either group alone. Now, I think that's a really powerful observation because the receptor manipulations are a bottom-up intervention. Just don't do anything behaverally with a person, right? You don't even need to know there's a person there, really, except to evaluate the efficacy. Your intervention is at the level of receptors. But top-down information, cognitive behavioral therapy, top-down intervention, is actually out to change the patient's beliefs, their patterns of interaction with the world. And Beck himself used the phrase cognitive restructuring, trying to restructure cognition at a very high level. And I think the lesson here is that doctors in practicing medicine with the patient need to take both of these realities into consideration, right? So this is real stuff with really practical outcomes that we're talking about here. This isn't just airy-fairy, academic classroom philosophy. So my conclusion is that beliefs matter, that cognitive restructuring matters, that high-level states of the nervous system that incorporate beliefs and values and aspirations actually matter for our behavior. And some people actually want to say, well, what are some examples? Give me some examples. So I'll give you examples of three questions that really matter, depend on your beliefs, and that are, I would say, almost completely inaccessible to science. So the first is this question, is it better to live or to die? And that's a real question for people who some of us know quite well. And that question is not susceptible to going into a laboratory doing an experiment for. It is an important question, arguably the most important question that anyone can ask. But there are others. So here's another one. Should I pursue a professional opportunity elsewhere in the country at the cost of uprooting my entire family, all of whom have their own independent lives? What experiment are we going to do in a science lab to answer that question? Here's another one. Should I marry this particular person? You know, we're going to go in the lab and do something to answer that question. I don't think so, right? What kind of criteria do you use to answer a question like this? You use things like, you know, your experience, you think about it as hard as you can, but in the end, you have to take a plunge. And I would say that the religious quest it involves the same sort of reasoning and same sort of experience as this marriage example. So sources of evidence are available, right? We're not going to check our brain at the door for any of these decisions. We can have our primary experience with the religious community or the marriage example, your primary experience with a potential partner, the testimony of other seekers throughout the ages, as well as critical reflections of people going through the same kind of things that we're doing. So we think, we gather evidence as much as we can, but in the end, the evidence alone is not compelling in a scientific sense, right? There's this moment when you have to jump. You have to make a leap. And I would say that faith accompanied by commitment is essential for any of these decisions. The risks are high. Anyone who's ever raised a teenager and, you've got to make these decisions every day on the basis of very uncertain data, very unpredictable outcomes. You know what I'm talking about, right? The risks are high, and it might not work out that well. But I would argue that this is the case of normal decision-making in human life. I would say this is simply the human condition. It's life, and our most consequential decisions in life have little or nothing to do with science. And I would say that for everyone, when we ask religious questions and get down to a real religious, serious religious inquiry about the world, for everyone, the real ultimate question is there an ultimate source of meaning and value in the universe? And if so, what is it? And that's really the deep question that I think all of us long to answer. Now, most people in this room, though perhaps not everyone, will be from a Christian faith and will have found these kinds of answers in the context of their Christian faith. Some of my professional colleagues may watch this video when it gets put on the web and not buy that at all. But I would say that I relate deeply to Jesus as he's presented by the gospel writers and in the early experience of the church. And I'm particularly identified with the story in the 6th chapter of John. That's a really long chapter. We're down in verses 66 and 68 here. Jesus had done some particularly difficult elements of teaching that nobody really understood. And it's interesting. The texts say that after this, many of his disciples drew back and no longer went about with him. And Jesus said to the 12, "Do you also wish to go away?" Now, that's interesting, right? That implies there were a lot of disciples in addition to the 12. Some of them jumped ship at some point. Stuff was too hard. Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom would we go? You have the words of eternal life." And, I think I resonate with that. I've been around academia a long time. I've read a lot of philosophy. I've read a lot of science. But I haven't found any words of life that rival those of Jesus, that make sense of my role, that make sense of my moral condition, that make sense of a web of relationships. I haven't seen any that do as well as the tradition that I'm living in. And there's this interesting little cognitive thing here, right? In the very next verse, Simon Peter says, "And we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." But look at the structure of that sentence. That's really interesting, right? It doesn't say, we have come to know, it's been proven to us that you are the Holy One of God, and therefore we believe. It says, "We have believed and then come to know that you're the Holy One of God." It's like that jump you take in a marriage or in a new job or, is it better to live or die, right? It's that interesting cognitive flip from the way that science is normally conceived of it as running. So to me, it's kind of reminiscent of this pretty famous quote from C.S. Lewis in The Weight of Glory that has this interesting cognitive flip as well. He says, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, the sun, but because by it I see everything else. It illumines everything else that you see. It's a way of interpreting and understanding all of reality." So I will just close here with my favorite quote from, one of my favorite quotes from Frederick Buechner. Everybody's got a favorite Buechner quote, right? And at the risk of, you know, I like this, so I'll show it anyway. It's in his book, Wishful Thinking, right? And it's a little essay on Jesus. And he says, what was brought to completion by such a life and such a death, only he can know wherever he is, if he is anywhere, referring to Christ. The Christ of it is beyond our imagining. All we can know is the flesh and blood of it, the Jesus of it. And of course, that's what we experience vicariously through the testimony of the Gospels. In that sense, what was completed was at the very least a hope to live by, a mystery to hide our faces before, a shame to haunt us, a dream of holiness to help make bearable our night. So there are words to live by here and deep sources of meaning that I think are relevant today. I think neuroscience is very relevant to understanding our behavior, the way we make decisions, higher order levels of nervous function that are our beliefs and aspirations. And I don't think there's any more important agenda in neuroscience than understanding those things. But at the same time, this person, at least, of two minds, finds value and finds meaning in these ancient truths and ancient traditions contained in the Bible. So I'll end here and just say thanks. And I think I've done this well enough that we have at least 5 minutes left for a few question and answers. But I'm going to let...
By Nancy Murphy's views a lot.
I'm sorry. I'll repeat the question. Go ahead. Am I influenced by Nancy Murphy's views? Thank you for that. Here's the next slide. this is a book that Nancy published about, I don't know, it's 15 years ago now. This has been a theme of her work in Christian philosophy at Fuller. Bodies and souls are spirited bodies. You know, if humans a dichotomy between bodies and souls, or do we have bodies that are actually spirited? And you know, she does a lot of neuroscience in this book, and she's influenced by her colleagues there in the psychology school for. And I think she gets the neuroscience really right. I think she's really good on this. I can't speak as well for the philosophy of theology, but the picture that Nancy builds in here, and she commits to a materialistic notion of the brain, as you can tell that I do. I don't believe that freedom equals uncaused. She commits to a reductionistic kind of understanding, but not this eliminative reductionism, where you get fundamental truth at one level and you can then throw away everything else. So I'm influenced by Nancy. I love talking with her on the rare occasions I get to talk with her. And I think she gets a lot of stuff right in this book that I highly recommend.
Thank you. So electroshock therapy used for depression is a bottom-up.
Yeah.
And that you suggest you need both bottom-up and top-down, but psychiatrists always use it as a last resort. So how do you feel about present-day electroshock therapy, and should it be used as a last resort or sooner?
Yes, I think it should be used as a last resort. So we're talking about electroshock, electroconvulsive therapy is what we call it, or ECT. So let's be clear. ECT is, as you said, a last resort treatment for really serious, life-threatening depression. I've known two personal friends who've had ECT. It's been a tremendous help to both of them. But the reason it's used as a last resort is largely because of substantial side effects. And it has side effects particularly on short-term memory. One of my good friends who was a professional neuroscientist, he would just walk around in a fog for days after his ECT treatment, really trying to understand, you know, what he was doing and where he was going. And not everyone has those kind of side effects. But man, I'll tell you, both of these friends of mine, ECT was really, probably literally a lifesaver for them. So I think it is good. I think it has major side effects. And I would like nothing better than to see a manipulation where we can actually go in and target specific circuits that control mood and affect without having to pass electrical current through the entire brain. Which is essentially what ECT does. ECT is a very non-specific shotgun kind of treatment, like most of our drug treatments, honestly, you know, that flow all over the brain, influencing any their matching transmitter receptor molecules anywhere they find them. And what we really want to be able to do is intervene in specific circuits to treat depression. And I think that there are technologies on the horizon for that that we'll get to. Will we get to it in 5 years? I don't think so. Will we get to it in 20? I think there's a good shot at that.
AJ Roberts, I got a big voice, so hopefully I can do it without the mic.
Go for it. I'll repeat your question.
Fantastic talk. Thank you very much. I'm wondering, you must be aware of the gentleman in the 2007 Lancet report who's missing about 75 to 80% of his brain.
Yeah.
And there must be other cases out there as well. Your comments or thoughts on individuals like that?
Yeah, are you talking about the reports of minimally conscious or persistent vegetative state?
No, this guy's actually functioning. I think his IQ was measured at 75. He's married, has two kids, functions on a normal basis.
Okay, I should see that paper. I don't know that paper. I mean, I do know of, you know, people, kids who have a rare genetic disorder where one cerebral hemisphere doesn't develop. Or they have the corpus callosum that doesn't develop, which, you know, is a major bundle of 100 million nerve fibers that links the two cerebral hemispheres, and it doesn't develop. And this is not discovered until they have, you know, a seizure at age 20. I mean, you know, one was an undergraduate at UCLA. The fact that she didn't have a corpus callosum was discovered at age 20, and she was a normally functioning person. So if this stuff happens early in life, the brain that's there is remarkably adaptive and remarkably plastic and can accommodate many functions. And perhaps that's what happened in this particular case, if it was a condition from early life.
It was.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, to lose that much of your brain as an adult, I think, would be devastating. I forgot exactly what question you were asking. I'm sorry.
I got into the science.
So what might be going on? I mean, what do I think about individuals? I think each individual has to be treated as an individual. Even, you know, IQ varies enormously, and emotional responsiveness varies enormously in the population in ways that we don't understand biologically yet. And we treat them all as individual people, of course, and I'm sure you mean that. But in terms of understanding it scientifically, I think the brain, the plasticity, you know, the amazing adaptive abilities of babies' brains and young kids' brains just to soak up information and to adapt new solutions to the problems that present themselves, that's what accounts mostly for that kind of remarkable thing. Because you make the same injuries in an adult, and it's devastating.
Last question.
To use some jargon that you're probably familiar with, would you agree that you would be a deterministic compatibilist?
You know, I get lost in the isms sometimes.
What I mean by that term. It seems that you, in your reference to quantum mechanics,
yes.
You might be able to
yeah.
say that, yes, if you had a big enough computer at the Big Bang, that
yeah,
it
yeah.
might be able to chart everything
yeah.
out.
So I'm definitely not a determinist, right? I mean, I'm convinced by whichever school it is, the Copenhagen school or the other one, you know, that quantum mechanics is fundamentally a probabilistic description of reality. And there are quantum mechanical effects on our lives. So the classic quantum mechanical effect is photon absorption, right? And if we get too many photon absorptions at certain points in our skin, you can develop a melanoma that ends your life and influences tremendously the future of your family, your kids, the social circle around you, and that's all quantum mechanics. You know, that's all photon absorptions and DNA being built up. So there are these quantum mechanical multipliers. I mean, low vision, a vision in dim light, you know, where we can detect single photons or just a few photons. Those are quantum mechanical absorptions in the retina. And, you know, if you're out in a serious jungle and your predators on many sides, detecting those few photons, that quantum mechanical event can make the difference between life and death. So I think that kind of indeterminism is real in our world, but as nearly as I can tell from talking to multiple biophysicists, and this can all change, right, with new insights and new knowledge, quantum mechanical effects are not major effects in the brain in fundamental signaling of cells electrically, because the macromolecules that comprise ion channels, they're too big for quantum mechanical effects to have serious mechanical effects. There is noise in the brain, but it's mostly thermal noise. It's not quantum mechanical noise. The noise is really important. Actual rigid determinism is terrible for animals, because if you have rigid determinism and your habits are eminently predictable, you will get eaten at the water hole by a predator. Or, you know, if I know pizza is delivered to your office door every day at 11:45, I might come and get it at 11:40. Stochasticity is really important in behavior because it keeps us from getting stuck in energy levels. You know, it keeps us exploring the environment. So I think there are actually, if there weren't natural sources of stochastic variability in the brain would have to invent them. It would be essential for survival. So I wouldn't say I'm deterministic, but I think there are mechanisms. But I think stochasticity built into those mechanisms. That was a long-winded answer.